Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the MacroCast. I'm your host, Ilan Moy, a managing director at Penta. My co-hosts are John Fagan and Brendan Walsh of Markets Policy Partners. And today we have a special guest, Matt Dell'Orfano, senior analyst at a large hedge fund and a professor at Columbia Business School. Most importantly, he's a longtime friend of the pod. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Ilan.
Great. Well, welcome back from the Thanksgiving break. We are now in the thick of the holiday shopping season. And I can tell you that I have probably a mountain of packages that are unopened in my garage right now. So it seems like everyone is, you know, starting to embrace the holidays and head out to the mall. We have some initial figures from the National Retail Federation, which reported that a record 200.4 million consumers shopped between Thanksgiving Day through Cyber Monday. And that number did beat their expectations. And it also includes both people who went to physical stores, bricks and mortar stores, as well as people who shopped online. And this year, in fact, the number of people who shopped online surpassed the number of people who went to physical stores, 134 million versus 121 million. So, Matt, it seems like if you're just looking at these early numbers, the consumer is doing pretty well. But what might be underneath the hood?
I think in general, the numbers are pretty good. And I think that shouldn't be a terribly large surprise from given where we were in terms of spending in Q3. Obviously, things are slowing down. A couple of things that are always notable when you look at the holiday spending is the revisions for the official numbers and whether it's the retail sales numbers. And I know you mentioned the NRF data are always quite large because it's a big part of the year. And so you don't really actually know how much people spent until sometime at the end of February. It's pretty much how it all shakes out. So having that in mind, I think if you're whether you're a policymaker or whether you're an analyst, macro, whomever, you know, the sequential month on month spending on a real basis is a great way to look at it. A couple, again, just to follow up on the words of caution, when we think about numbers, a lot of people have taken to some of the alternative data, credit cards. I think the last couple of years that has become even less indicative, ironically, after becoming a very useful tool because of the buy now and pay later components to it. When it comes to the retail traffic online, I think that's a wonderful indicator. I think those are absolutely great ways to look at the trend. But this year and last year, but this year in particular, it's going to be very wonky how that traffic actually translates into dollars. A couple of the really simple reasons are this is a first year in almost, we'll call it two, but 2 or 3 years where retailers really haven't have had to start to discount. And they don't necessarily mean they're discounts that are massive or that are changing the profitability structures, but we're seeing prices be cut on a relative basis. So when you look at the year-on-year volume trend, which is, hey, how many people went online, you'd be really careful when we think about how to move that to an actual dollar trend. And we've seen increases in discounting across wide surveys. And we've also, of course, seen it in the margin numbers and many of the durable goods numbers for sure in the PPI and CPI numbers, where we're starting to see what we'll call disinflation around the pricing, where retailers and wholesalers that pass these goods on have had to give some pricing back. Those are just a couple of things you should think about as you're looking through those numbers.
Yeah, I think you bring up a couple of really interesting points that I'd like to unpack a little bit more. You brought up some changes and some maybe variability and sort of how and when people are shopping, the methods they're using to pay for their purchases, as well as, you know, shifts in pricing among retailers. So if we could maybe hit each of those in turn, because I think they're super fascinating. In terms of how and when people shop, I know that we've talked before in this podcast about perhaps some pricing or some foot traffic, online traffic being pulled forward because folks are looking for some of those deals. Black Friday, Cyber Monday may not be quite the landmark days that they used to be because our shopping habits are changing, not just post-pandemic, but even for several years before that, for a while before that. So, you know, I'm curious how you feel about the flow of holiday shopping throughout the season. It's not just...
It's a super important point. And I think whenever I try and think about these problems, I try to put myself in the shoes of the person who actually has to deal with them versus pontificate on them. So if you put yourself in the CEO's or CFO's office of a, let's say it's a major brick and mortar retailer with a great online presence as well. So nothing, no mix issues there. They're doing a great job. They have their planning team all set coming into the season. What's the inventory? What are the discounts we're going to give? They see their Black Friday numbers, their Cyber Monday numbers. And then they have to stare at the screen for the next 2 weeks while they wait to see if that actually follows through before the rush where everyone has to finally buy the Christmas presents, right? So when you think about the flow in general, these next couple of weeks are obviously very important. That's where those are the weeks where you're going to know that you can clear your inventory to the level where you can take it down and follow your original discounting plan into the actual holiday. And then, of course, at which point you have to get rid of what's left. You don't want to have what's left, right? Especially in a year when you've had discounting. So generally speaking, I think when the online shopping became much more relevant, at first, folks had generally planned for the quarter the way they always used to plan for the quarter. And now you had this large initial channel. And these, of course, I'm saying, speaking in generalities over a bunch of years, you had this great new channel come in and you pulled a lot of that demand forward at prices you knew. Forget there was a discount. If you planned for, if it was a $100 item and you say, we're going to discount it by 20, and that's in your quarterly plan, you only care about the $80. The 20s are, it's already gone because you planned for the 80. So then when you say, oh my gosh, I can pull all this stuff forward and know that I have the $80 in my pocket for that piece of the inventory I planned for, then I can actually sell through my rest. I can adjust my pricing on the way down to push out the rest of the inventory. But now that people have sort of planned as part of their original annual plan to push items from the beginning of the selling season that starts pretty early, you know, the week before Black Friday or whatever. Now you're sort of, that cadence includes a big chunk at the beginning and then this kind of lull of 2 weeks, and a big chunk at the end. So they're still, they have a plan. It just happens to look different. And I think the flow has evolved because they've tried to capture that competitively. So right now, I'm sure they're all staring at their screens waiting for this weekend, frankly. I hope that helps sort of illustrate the from the shoes of whomever would be planning and hoping for those dollars.
And this year it was extra weird because we have a longer time between Thanksgiving and Christmas. There's that extra week because Thanksgiving was early. And I know that oftentimes throws off some projections and traffic as well.
Sure. No, but these are relevant things, and you're seeing, you know, I've made this comment, I think, on this podcast before but we were talking about the topic of inflation, where if you're really thinking about what does the retail inflation specifically, like, honestly, check your inbox. Because when you're seeing like the emails come in and it's like, we extended our Cyber Monday and it's the next week, well, you know that they're still needing to move product and they're pushing. Maybe it was planned, maybe it wasn't, but those are kind of the things that that you can see. And we're definitely seeing continued push to move volumes, especially at price points, which they've already discounted from what were really high levels.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about, Matt, the some of the headlines that you see about buy now, pay later when talking about, you know, the different ways in which people are making their purchases. There is sort of an implication that buy now and pay later is an indication of consumer exhaustion. Is that really accurate?
The truth is, I don't know. Is that right? Here's a framework to think about it. And buy now, pay later in the last, it's actually been around for a long time. It just used to be called layaway. Right? Like, it's not like we did this in the 80s. I know people don't remember that. There was the room at the back of the Kmart. And like, I know that in our family, like, sometimes you have to put stuff on layaway, right? So my point is like, you have to do that. So now that it's been modernized and you do get the thing to start, right? You get it up front or whatever, and you pay for it over time. Buy now, pay later went through a bunch of different phases where, and I'm talking all in the last 3 or 4 years, where effectively they had a lot of capital. These firms that do buy now, pay later, they had capital. And think about the money they had in two buckets: the money they could use to finance the stuff you're buying, and in the other bucket was the money they were using to market their new businesses and venture capital. And they'd raised a bunch of money to do cool stuff, develop cool technology, integrate with the payment systems, et cetera. And part of that was marketing. And they were very good at what I'll call SEO, you know, search engine optimization and customer acquisition. Maybe they use Facebook, maybe they use some other big companies that, you know, Google advertising and other means, but they were able to get to those consumers. So let's talk about an example of how that would work for a sec. Let's say I wanted to get a bunch of consumers because I wanted to integrate buy now, pay later with a retailer for teen apparel. Just doesn't matter which one. So, and I go and I contact through marketing people, channels is what they do, right? I get in touch with a couple of influencers, and I don't necessarily mean, you know, the highest end, you know, billionaire influencers on Instagram, but real ones that matter for that demographic that I'm targeting. And you go to them and say, look, we're going to pay you. I need you to drive, but in order to pay, get paid, you need to drive this much traffic to this point. Great. They come to some general framework agreement. With that framework agreement, they would approach the CFO of the retailer and then say, look, I need you to integrate into the payment system. And that guy would say, dude, I don't have CapEx to do this right now. My tech people, like, why am I doing this? And they're like, we are going to drive not only your volume, but you're going to see that you're going to get full price item sales. And he or she said, okay, I'll give it a shot because, you know, you give me either upfront money for the CapEx or I'll do it because I had to do it anyway, but let's see how it goes. So because they had these marketing dollars to sell, to provide, what they're effectively doing is you had a retailer who would normally have to go get their own customer. Let's say that customer would buy $30 of stuff in a basket. These numbers are totally hypothetical. They're just for example. Well, then you would come in, and you would say, these buy now, pay later people would bring not only the financing, but the actual customer volume. So now your customer's showing up, they're being influenced, and they probably have a basket that doesn't look like 30. Some of them are up more than 100%, but let's go with $50. And $50 at full price items. So you're getting your margin on that incremental $20 is really high. Let's say it's 10, when your margin on the $30 basket might have only been $5 or $7 after shipping. So the margin dollars of these baskets were going up 100, 200%. And so these buy now, pay later folks were driving a ton of business. They got integrated. You saw this growth. But the growth wasn't necessarily because of the financing. Their growth was because they were pushing volume to retailers and people had money to spend, irrespective of where it came from. They had money to spend. Stimulus was a big part of it, et cetera. Awesome. So now we're in this spot where buy now, pay later is converting itself to an actual financing tool, right? And so is it integrated? Yes. Does it replace, is it closer to a credit card now than it was to both a volume and financing tool before? It is. The retailers aren't going to get rid of it because there's still have plenty of optionality there. But the reality is that the growth we saw is now was driven by the fact that there were marketing dollars to spend on that volume and the retailers were super happy about it. Are they still happy to have the financing tool? Yes. But is it closer to a PayPal button, right? Like another wallet option than it is to actually something they would expect a lot of volume growth from? It is. So when I look at that, I would say that from a consumer's point of view, it's definitely converting more towards a credit card. I know they technically define themselves differently. A credit card where you have a consumption opportunity, you don't see the interest necessarily as an interest payment, and the retailer is often happy to continue that volume channel and perhaps even give some discount or give you a different shopping basket presentation if you're using that format because it drives their volume and they're content. You're still seeing higher price items versus shopping for discount, right? Because the retailer would rather have a high price item than a full price item than a discounted item that the consumer feels they have to buy on sale because they're going to put it on their charge card. So I feel like there's still a nice balance there, but it is definitely converted and people should look at the growth with a little bit more of an operational eye now than and understand where the initial excitement came from because it wasn't all just because folks needed financing.
Matt, is that shift though happening because the buy now, pay later companies are investing fewer marketing dollars? Or is the shift happening because consumers are now used to this tool and, as you mentioned, sort of using it differently and maybe not using it to finance those full price purchases in the same way that they were before? Or maybe consumers just simply have less money than they used to because of the end of season. So.
It's all of them. For sure, it's less marketing dollars, number one. Consumers are definitely using it as a financing tool. And I will also say that the financing tool isn't always a bad thing, right? There are people who want to consume a certain item and they choose to spend their hard-earned dollars on that item, but they need some time to spread out that item, that's a consumption decision. It's okay. They want the thing. It's going to cost them a little extra to buy the thing because they can't pay up front for it, but they still want it. And I think that's a fantastic option to have in everyone's wallet. Clearly,
it's a great point. Credit. Anytime we see a slight uptick in, you know, credit card you, from historic lows, all the bears freak out that, you know, the sky is falling. It's like, well, no, that's actually what it's there for. And
right,
it's a trend to watch, but it doesn't mean that the end of the world is that the sky is falling.
No, and like I said, they probably also look, we know from other measures and wage growth slowing down slightly, and we'll talk about that probably a little bit later, but we know from other measures that there's less dollars around. But I think it has become a smoothing tool. We are certainly seeing aggregate credit card debt go back up. Without getting into a fundamental argument on how to measure it, like we put a lot of nominal dollars into the system, and so having the nominal number of credit card dollars as debt go up is reasonable, right? That's not like a strange, it's not a reach, right? We can talk in percentages, et cetera, but when you throw $5 trillion into the economy and then credit card go debt or whatever percentage of GDP, right? Credit card debt goes up by a bunch. That's not really terribly shocking, but people are looking at the level and saying, oh my gosh, normally it was X and now it's X plus Y, it's so much higher. So I think we also have to balance that a little bit.
There may not be a smoking gun, whether it's, you know, whether it's buy now, pay later, whether it's, you know, rising credit card debt. Obviously, you know, we all heard the management commentary from Walmart and Target about, you know, some fraying on the margins of their, you know, the consumer wherewithal to purchase, particularly in lower socioeconomic categories. But, you know, it really is it's a situation where the markets are definitely, you know, pondering what is going to get better for the consumer from here. I mean, we may not see falling off the cliff, but, you know, is this just a steady erosion that ends up in sort of, you know, a consumer recession sometime in the future?
Well, let me throw something out on that point, because this isn't really important for policy people to think about is there's also other stuff going on, right? Right now, I mean, wage growth and, you know, let's use something close to the ECI, right? Let's call it 4% is still happening. All right. Now, last year, when inflation was somewhere between 4 and 8, you can pick your number, but really high, right? Real wages. So what people had in their pocket at the end of the day was going down, not up. Now, what we have seen thus far is wages have stayed, call it 4-ish, just like we said a second ago. But we are run rating in Q4 inflation that's pretty darn close to 2. There's nuances to it. There's certain items. There's a mix for the consumers, et cetera. But generally speaking, we are either at or quickly approaching that 2% level. So arguably, if that 2% level is pretty sustainable and there's reasons, you know, PPI margins coming down, goods prices coming down, on the headline, oil coming down, right? All those different elements, putting that stuff together, it's not an unreasonable middle of the distribution curve case to say, boy, wages should probably come in from 4 to 3. But if inflation is down around 2, people are actually going to be arguably richer next year than they were in the last 2 years, right? So the consumer recession, the slowdown may happen, but not necessarily. That's a big padding that we have in there, which helps people as we go into the new year. That doesn't mean there aren't other elements that will make them slow down spending, but that's something to think about as you monitor the consumer pain.
There's something that you said in our last podcast, John, that has really stuck with me, and I've thought about it quite often since you said it, which is, you know, we can't have a soft landing without softening. And it seems like, you know, even if consumers may have that padding from inflation going down while wages are still still rising, mm-hmm. But the sentiment around that shift, I think, is not going to be a positive one. I think consumers are going to, maybe they'll see the prices go down, but they're going to be saying, look, am I am I making, how much more am I making than I was before? How easy is it for me to find a job? How easy is it for me, if I wanted to change jobs, would I be able to find a new one? And even though the job market is still, pretty hot, the amount of hiring is certainly slowing down, and consumer sentiment has been not very strong. So I guess I bring that up to say, the consumer seems to have a gloomier picture than what the real economy would suggest they should have. And is that part of the softening that we need to see in order for some of the froth to come out of the system and for us to reach a more sustainable and normalized level of growth?
There's definitely, those points are very valid. Behaviors will certainly change let's give a hypothetical. Let's say the non-farm payroll, the hiring number that everyone generally looks at and is reported in the newspaper says, hey, there were zero jobs created, right? We're not falling into some massive recession, but it's hard to get a job. Quit rates are down, right? So because people aren't switching over. People still feel okay about wages, but if they're still thinking that inflation is going to take away most of those earnings, then yes, there will certainly be a slowdown. If they think that there's no financing available, yes, there will certainly be a slowdown. And I would also bring in the level of rates for Main Street, I'll call it. So if you think of our economy, you have to remember that a huge chunk of it is small businesses, right? And many of those small businesses are consumptive. Many of those small businesses support a lot of folks. And at the same time, right now, if you're a small business and you need to buy inventory and borrow from a bank to do it, your cost to do that is somewhere between 9 and 14%, right? Your working capital.
And Matt, it's something we talked about in the past too. But even more importantly, the vast majority of those small businesses have never had to run that business with rates this high. It was always easy to just keep turning over because money was, very, very cheap.
Right. And so I think when we talk about, without overlapping into the Fed and what they're going to cut and the exact amount of cuts, when we talk about that front end rate having to come down, not because we're falling into recession, right, but to start to respond to the tightening, which has happened very effectively, that would be an example of how does it actually matter? Well, the person who's the supplier for the local building materials or the guy who supplies the snowplow equipment someplace in New Hampshire, that guy, in order to finance the snowplows on his lot, is paying 14%. He needs to move those units, right? If you have 200-300 basis points or 200 basis points come off the front end, and even if the 10-year stays the same, he's much better off.
Yeah.
Right. His spread compressed so low. He probably goes, even though he goes down, his loan price goes down by more than 200 basis points. Right. So he's sitting there. That saves him a lot of money when he thinks about his capital stack. So bringing that back to the consumer, like, how crunched are people feeling? We have to sort of understand how the small business is feeling as well. And you're definitely going to get that softening. I think, again, inflation, whether it's the hey, I don't feel as poor this year because my wages went up and inflation went down. Or if it's just as simple as the normal consumer surveys you see in the University of Michigan Consumer Survey, inflation expectations. If that stuff rolls off by a couple, by a point or so, because gas and groceries came lower, which is generally what the driver of that survey is at the end of the day, then you're going to have some improvement that offsets these things. And again, this is all sort of ceteris paribus in terms of like, jobs aren't collapsing. People are still continuing to keep the labor that they have. And generally, that's what a soft landing, with softening would look like. And we'll probably see the economic response or the policy response that's necessary in the back half of next year because of sort of these intricate interlaced issues between small business, working capital funding, personal credit cards, et cetera.
Yeah, I think that's a good summary that the economy is okay, but the biggest risk of 2024 is a Fed policy mistake that, either they stay too hawkish and drive us into a recession, which probably be led by small businesses, or if they, inflation continues to come off and they actually do begin to normalize rates to an appropriate level for the economy that we have.
Yeah, I think the market is really like clamoring for, needs a little extra clarity from the Fed. We've got Chair Powell speaking today, but maybe not in the kind of venue where he would really give detailed policy signals. Who knows? But, you know, the idea that we've seen data dependent and higher for longer, those two formulations that the, you know, are kind of the tent poles of what the Fed has been saying in terms of its guidance. And those were kind of aligned in October, because the data coming in for September was strong. Your data dependent and higher for longer matched, right? And then all of a sudden in November, the data kind of took a step back. And that, and that, you know, higher for longer was sort of sublimated, although the Fed officials kept saying it and kept beating that drum. It was not validated by the data the way it had been previously. And so investors, you know, started to look much more closely at the Fed as data dependent, and have been discounting this higher for longer. So it'll be interesting to see if the Fed, like a lot of other global central bankers, are trying to rhetorically push back over the coming weeks on these, you know, creeping forward expectations for rate cuts and for more rate cuts, you know, than previously anticipated.
I think that's completely fair. And again, it does take time for these things to pass through. But it's very likely that the data in Q1 is going to be substantially similar to Q4 or slightly slower. And so now you have two quarter trend. And I think people will get more comfortable with that. As for what has to be done immediately at the Fed, given everything that's happened and given the nature to sort of, in my view, they have to kind of reassert their authority in terms of their decision-making process and their communication, I think it's totally reasonable for them to say, okay, the cadence of the data dependency is a little bit longer. And we're going to look at a couple quarters, and we're seeing these quarters move. And so now we're going to actually address the problems in the real economy if they've popped up. And I think that's a very reasonable approach and a very practical one that the market and definitely businesses would appreciate. It's very tangible.
One question that I've been thinking about is whether the loosening of financial conditions impacts the Fed's decision around its higher for longer mantra. There's been some, I guess, chatter around whether, because financial conditions are easier, whether even if the Fed holds steady, effectively monetary policy is tighter, and that could also lead to a slowdown in economic growth. So the Fed ends up hitting the brakes harder than it intends because we've seen Treasury yields come back down. What do you think of that interplay? And do you think the Fed is that responsive, Matt, to what we're seeing in financial markets?
So it's out of my area of my circle of competence to understand their response function. But what I would say that's completely reasonable to think about is the easing of financial conditions, when people talk about it, they often talk about it on average, right? The 10-year came down, the stock market went up, they do some equation and they say, hey, this is financial conditions are easier, right? Maybe it's a very reasonable econometric equation, but I'll just go back to what we talked about a few minutes ago, where it's in order for the local bank to give the local person who needs working capital a lower rate, the front end of the curve has to come down because it's a 6 to 1 6 month to 1 year working capital loan. And that's just how they're priced, right? So when you think about where they have to be easing on the curve, that can be a very different question from our aggregate financial conditions easier. All of that is X the considerations around bigger market liquidity. And maybe market liquidity comes from normal 401k deposits. Maybe market liquidity comes from what's going on with the Fed balance sheet or the Treasury's need for capital at a certain period in time. All those things are real. On average, they seem to be getting less liquid versus more liquid. So I think it's all in, they have to consider those things in the back. But the response function around where the curve is, we probably have to think about in terms of the duration of each need. For mortgages, we care a lot about the 10-year. For working capital and small businesses, we care a lot about the front end. So how do we balance those things is very important. And talking about the mortgages, we've seen pricing come down in the last 2 weeks, right? Materially. We've even seen spreads compress on the mortgages relative to where they were. Given the buying power and the securitization in the market. I don't think spreads are going to go back to what they used to be, which is 140 to 170 over the 10-year. They're probably going to be a bunch higher for a while, for maybe forever, but probably not at 350 where they were, and you know, when things were, when rates were really ripping higher. And so when I think about that impact, there's a benefit for consumers there. And maybe that condition is materially more loose than it was before. But the front end probably does need to be adjusted in a thoughtful way. And as for the exact timing, the market loves to speculate on those things, on the cuts and the euro dollar curve and the front end, et cetera. But thinking through that, it's probably a reasonable thing to think about over the summer or into the back half of the year, once we get through the first quarter numbers.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal article that came out that people are citing this morning was, you know, Fed insiders at the Fed are, you know, Fed sources say that that the FOMC probably thinks that rate hikes are done, but they're afraid to say it. And you just see and you're like, the market, go ahead and say it. I mean, the market has completely moved on. Right. There's almost a 0% chance of additional rate hikes being priced in. And at this point, you know, if you're, if you are going to be communicating and trying to, you know, pull back some of the, you know, some of the loosening of financial conditions that occurred in November, you've really got to focus on sort of shoving back those rate cut expectations, which have crept up to a 50-50 odds implied in futures for a rate cut starting in March. And 125 basis points. And with upside risk for the total year, that's really aggressive. And so, you know, the Fed, I think, you know, very much agree with what you said, Elon. It's, you know, in, with these expectations now pretty, you know, pretty significantly tilted in the dovish direction, it's not that hard for the Fed to get a little bit of rhetorical tightening done by, you know, by trying to push back on those, if indeed those, that pushback is credible.
Well, John, isn't leaking to the Wall Street Journal that you think that you're done hiking the same as just coming out and saying you're done hiking?
Yeah, exactly.
Otherwise, I mean, we just cut out the middleman, you know?
Markets are way past that.
You can preserve optionality by then blaming the reporter and saying
that. I get that, yeah. Well, that's what you used to do, Elon. So yeah, you were that middle layer to leak it out to see how the reaction is.
The whisper, the trial balloon, if you will.
I think a lot of this will get some more clarity when the Fed has a chance to adjust their everyone loves to call it the dots, but their inflation projections, etc. I mean, I think we still have 2.7 or maybe almost 3% inflation expected by Q4 of 2025 in the dots. If I'm not, I'm doing that from memory. So I'm not so, but I feel like we're running a 2 now. So probably need to adjust a couple things. And I think with that new framework, they put in the new framework and then they can take another step, pause for a month or two, look at some more data, see if jobs are holding up in the spring, which I think people are pretty nervous about, and then decide what they want to do from there. I think there's a reasonable way to layer in that cadence. It's on the Fed timeline, which is, you know, versus the market timeline. We're thinking in days and they're thinking in quarters, right?
Well, we'll see what kind of data Santa delivers for the Fed later on this month. That does it for us here today at the MacroCast. I'm Elon Moy with Penta. My co-hosts are Brendan and John of Markets Policy Partners. Thank you so much to our special guest, Matt Dellofano, for joining our conversation. And as a reminder, any views expressed here are his own. We hope that you enjoyed our show, and remember that you can always listen, like, and subscribe to the MacroCast wherever you get your podcasts. Have a great day.